What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
My name is Jared. I'm joined here with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Hey, film fans.
And Jacob.
Hello, hello.
And Austin.
Yo.
This is very special because we thought Ryan was going to be on the phone today, and then 10 minutes before we started recording, he just shows up at the door.
And everyone's so happy. We're so happy, man.
And I feel like I haven't seen him for, like, what, 2 months?
It's been a while,
it's
yeah.
Been a
happy
while.
New Year.
Happy New Year. So, man, you should do that more often.
Yeah, pop in on anytime. Anytime. Yeah,
I wish there was more federal holidays, that I could do that.
We could work on that.
Yeah. So, today, welcome back to Nick Cage Month, everybody. This is the second installment of Nick Cage Month. Today, we're covering Face Off, the 1997 movie directed by John Woo.
Face Off Day!
Can I just say, I love how Nick Cage Month doesn't actually settle in an actual calendar month, but it straddles
two.
Because that's like totally Nick Cage. It's eccentric and doing its own thing, right?
Exactly.
Nick Cage. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, does whatever the fuck he wants.
You know we get meta like that. Anyway, so we have two more movies after this one for Nick Cage Month, and we decided that we're going to leave it to the patrons. So if you guys go to wisecrackplus.com, you can join the Patreon, and you can cast your vote as to what Nick Cage movies you'd like to see. In the running are Adaptation, Raising Arizona. All right, it's a little bit late.
I think there's Drive
Angry, Leaving Las Vegas, Knowing, Wild at Heart, Ghost Rider, Con Air, Moonstruck, and Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
That's a long list, too.
That's a long list, but we're going to get the top two. The top two are going to be the next two that we cover.
I will not be unhappy no matter what gets picked.
Well, that's what happens when you're covering Nick Cage. But anyway,
I haven't seen a lot of them, by the way.
I have not seen a lot of them.
Seen
either.
Them all. They're all good.
I contest that Matchstick Men is not in there. What's up with that?
I forgot about that one. I didn't. Yeah. I mean, look, he's been in like 75 movies. So
no Wicker
Man.
Wait,
so you've seen Ghost Rider?
Yeah.
Okay, I have not seen that one. All right, anyway, let's talk about Face Off. Let's go for first impressions. What was it like the first time you saw this movie? What was it like revisiting it? Let's start with our guest that we haven't seen in 2 months, Ryan.
Well, the first time I saw this, I like had a just mini teenage Ryan just movie orgasm. Like, I couldn't believe what I was watching. it's exactly what I want in a movie. I feel like I've said that on a couple podcasts recently. But yeah, this is exactly what I want out of the movie. It's just an absurd high concept situation, beautifully done and rendered with awesome John Woo slow-mo photography with batshit insane acting from Nick Cage and John Travolta. Everybody is hitting on all cylinders here. And yeah, this movie is amazing. Can't wait to talk about it.
Golf clap.
Okay, cool. What about you, Jacob?
I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I remember loving it then. And God, I watched it on the airplane this time. What a fucking great movie. I was like, yeah. I couldn't hold myself back. I was on the texting. I was like, dude, fucking John Woo's the man. This movie's awesome. The name is great. I love the double entendre with, like, obviously the face and a face off. The fucking action is insane. It's so good. You don't get that anymore. I kept thinking about John Woo. I kept thinking about Mission Impossible 2. I love the high concept. It's just perfect. It's a great movie. And then to be able to see these actors both kind of play each other was awesome. So you get like two performances out of each. So you get four performances. It's just, it's the best. I loved it. So yeah, it's like one of the best action movies ever. Unfortunately, the 90s. It's awesome.
Awesome. Austin, what about you?
I'm going to throw the wet blanket on this love parade here.
You motherfucker. No, boo.
I mean, there are a couple of good sequences. The Mexican standoff at the end. I like when they point the guns at the mirrors and it's like, oh, they're shooting the other, but they're really killing themselves. And there's some interesting stuff there. I thought that was a cool shot. And then some of the action sequences are just simply balletic, especially when they go into Caster's like lair or his apartment building. I mean, that was just a fucking crazy scene, right? Other than that, it was so hammy. And I get it. That's the point. You got to enjoy it on that level. But like Vampire's Kiss, for some reason, I could deal with this kind of hamminess. But with this, dude, it just didn't do it for me. I thought the storyline was ludicrous. I don't know. Like it for just
hey, look, not every movie can be Vampire's Kiss.
I know. Right. I know. I mean, and I know I should not get hung up on the science. But like, come on.
It's
the science
accurate,
is the best
man.
Part.
100% it's better than Inception.
More than human centipede.
Really, yeah. I mean, I would actually see. I didn't better see than the movie in 1997 or anywhere near that, but it kind of. I was like, wow. You know, people were really optimistic about science back in 1997.
Yeah, you suspend disbelief.
Well, I don't know. Like,
No, I definitely remember distinctly my dad and everyone talking about this movie and making fun of the concept. Oh, okay. Being like, yeah. Like, this is insane and ridiculous. Yeah. It was ridiculous back then. It's ridiculous now. But it doesn't matter. Like, when you're watching it, everyone plays it pretty straight. You know, it's not played for laughs, really.
Right. Yeah.
Like,
you just go
and
with
I love 15 minutes into the future scientific stuff. Like, I love that kind of stuff. You know, like the magnetized boots and things like that prison. I was like, oh, that's kind of fucking cool. It kind of like just amps up the craziness of the prison system. I was like, that's pretty fucking cool. But I don't know, man. It just didn't do it for me. I'm sorry.
Wasn't the security guard like Marge's husband from Fargo too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally is.
Or her.
No. Oh, no. Well, the director of the FBI was Mr. Gunderson.
Yeah, you had two Fargo actors. Yeah, but I think the security guard is Marge's husband, the one who's like, I want to make you some eggs.
Right. yeah. You got to have a
You got Arby's on you, Marge.
Yeah.
To your point, though, Austin, I really love the kind of logical jumps in this movie.
Me
and
too.
How they don't really address it, but you are kind of like, you know, they would totally recognize these people way earlier just by little quirks in their body. There's no way the thing would be that perfect.
The hair,
surgery.
Oh, yeah.
The teeth. You know,
yeah, the surgery is perfect. Well,
structure
it's funny to me,
whenever your nose,
I,
your jawline,
your eyeball
your
color,
gum line.
I don't know.
Well, I think that makes it fun.
Your breath.
I don't know. For me, it's all about the moment in history that the way that people feel about technology of whether or not you would buy that or not. Because, you know, you see all those machines, the computers that all look very state-of-the-art, high-tech for the time. And I don't know if it was, depending on the level of exponential technological growth that this movie came out in, which was 97. Once again, I saw this movie for the first time last night. So I was wondering in my head, I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe like, you know, in the past 2 years, computers had just exponentially gotten better to such a degree that people might actually believe that this might be a thing in a couple years. But you're probably right. It's probably ridiculous then and ridiculous. Well, it would be ridiculous now, no matter what.
Yeah, of course. So what did you think of the movie? Your first
viewing.
It
was awesome. It was my first viewing. The only thing I will say is I don't remember, first of all, I don't remember why we picked this movie. I think Ryan was like, Face Off. So I was
was
like,
it you?
Right,
I thought it was Jared.
If we're going to do Nick Cage month, we got to do fucking
but
Face
Off. But it's like Nick Cage is only doing the Nick Cage for the first like 20 minutes.
Which, I'm glad you said that because that's another great thing about the form and amazing acting of this movie is that is Nicolas Cage is playing a fucking sociopath, but he only gets the opening credit sequence to really cement, you know, that part. Him, Nick Cage, is Castor Troy being Castor Troy. And then from then on, it's John Travolta being Castor Troy.
Yeah.
So he has to play it totally different. But that opening sequence with the choir boy and him grabbing her ass, it's like, dude, it's amazing. That's the foundation for the character. Yeah, that face. You really are like, yeah, this guy's crazy.
Yes.
And then there's this amazing commentary track that Nick Cage talks about, you know, whenever they filmed that scene first. So that was the first scene that they filmed. And then John Travolta was over there watching, and he was like, wow, so that's the kind of acting we're going to be doing. Because he had to basically be him for the rest of the movie.
Exactly.
He's like, fuck, I got to do that. You know? Like, so that's Nick Cage is responsible for a lot of this movie.
You imagine like whatever energy he puts in.
You gotta keep them stakes high. Like,
absolutely. Yeah.
Whatever energy he put into that role, you had to have emulated by Travolta, which would have been crazy. Both of them had to really like observe each other to see like how are you with your wife, and how would you be in this situation? And man,
I didn't know this was a body swap film.
And best body swap film ever. Better than 18 Again. Better than 13 going on 30. Better than Freaky Friday.
Better than Get Out.
What was the one?
Yeah, I think so.
What was the one with Ryan Reynolds and Jason Bateman?
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah,
the voices?
No, it's where they do the Freaky Friday thing, but they do it with the two dudes, and Ryan Reynolds is like
it came out like 5 years ago or something.
Like the double? Was it called? No, not the double. That was the Jesse Eisenberg film. I know what you're talking about. The Switch or something like that.
Anyway.
The Switch. I think
that movie is
it.
Pretty impressive. I mean, it's not as good as this one.
Oh, someone recommended 8mm, another good movie.
Oh, shit. I haven't seen that one either. Yeah. Point is, I like this movie a lot. You know, it's weird because I love John Woo, and I'm more familiar with his movies in Hong Kong than I were in his ones in America. And the first thing that caught me was the fact that Nicolas Cage, in that first scene when he gets out of his car and like his trench coat is billowing in the wind and he's got those two ornate guns, I mean, he's basically Chow Yun-Fat from a Better Tomorrow.
Yeah. Mm.
And I thought that was really interesting. And that's kind of the lens through which I ultimately analyze this movie, and what we'll talk about is kind of how this movie is an interesting departure from John Woo's Hong Kong movies and even the first two movies he made in America, because before this there was Broken Arrow.
A failure.
And what was the other one?
Payback, but that was later.
Oh, I don't know. Was it not Wind Talkers? Was that?
Oh, yeah, he did Wind Talkers. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, I really like this movie. I love all John Woo action movies. It was cool to see a version of The Killer and Hard Boiled and
Bullet in the Head.
Yeah, with two American actors that I like a lot.
By the way, if you're listening to this, you don't know John Woo, those are the movies you should go check out. Bullet in the Head, The Killer, Hard Boiled,
and A Better Tomorrow. And I think there are some A Better Tomorrow sequels, which I haven't seen all of them, and they're not as good as the first one.
And then Mission Impossible 2, awesome, but that's him in America.
Yeah. And then the Red Cliff movies are pretty cool. Don't see the theatrical one that's condensed into one movie. See the foreign ones that are two-hour movies. Anyway, let's go into a recap. So,
yes.
Terrorist Caster Troy shoots FBI officer Sean Archer on a carousel, accidentally killing his young son in the process. 6 years later, Sean catches and puts Caster in a coma during his attempt to blow up L.A., but his bomb is still out there and his plan's still in motion. Caster's brother, also in custody, will only speak to Caster about the bomb, so Sean undergoes an experimental procedure to implant Caster's face onto his. With 6 days until the bomb explodes, Sean infiltrates the prison as Caster and learns the bomb is at the LA Convention Center. Meanwhile, the real Caster wakes up and makes the doctor put Sean's face on his, turning this into a veritable body swap film. Caster, as Sean, gets his brother out of jail and defuses the bomb to soak up the glory. He then has sex with Sean's wife and puts his plan into motion to cripple all other terrorist groups, leaving his crew to be the only big dogs in town. All the while, Sean, as Caster, rots away in jail. Sean, as Caster, escapes from jail, teams up with Caster's old crew, where he learns that Caster has a son that he has all but abandoned. Caster, as Sean, and the SWAT team start shooting up the place, leading to a face-off between Caster and Sean. Caster's brother dies, and Caster, as Sean, kills the director of the FBI. Sean, as Caster, convinces his wife who he really is, and at the director's funeral, a five-way Mexican standoff leads to an epic boat chase where Sean kills Caster, and the FBI recognizes him as Sean again. The top surgical team in the country comes in and gives Sean his face back, and the Archer family adopts Caster's orphan child. End of movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So this movie was pretty successful. This movie made $100 million in 6 weeks, which is
in 1996 money.
In 1996 wow. money, that's
seven,
like
97. This is Titanic.
97 money.
Titanic year.
And it's got like a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, which means that, I mean, not that we should take that aggregator as being some sort of like absolute barometer for good films, but at least, you know, it got some critical love.
The people like it.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you're talking about it kind of being a little hammy and cheesy. I mean, I'll admit, as a lover of this movie, yeah, like compared to other things, it is a little hammy and cheesy, but everyone likes it. And that's what is great about it. It transcends its, it wears its hamminess as a badge of honor.
And, I just put my critical mind on the hanger and was like, let me just enjoy it. Let me
I didn't. I was like,
you were analyzing
those doves,
every,
baby. Oh, what do they mean?
I was saying to the John Woo doves. I think there's doves in Mission Impossible 2.
Oh, there's doves
sure
in all his movies.
Doves in all his movies, right?
It means it's a metaphor for how important the movie is.
Yes.
I couldn't help but look at this into the context of Hong Kong cinema. And the thing you'll always hear from academics that talk about Hong Kong cinema is that Hong Kong cinema is always, especially in the 90s when it was big, when it was like basically became a big thing. It's all about expressing this anxiety about Hong Kong being taken over by China again in 1997. Like, they're pretty much all Hong Kong movies are analyzed under in that frame. And this movie doesn't really deal with that, but there are still some pretty interesting things that we can talk about in a sec. But in a sec, Freudian slip.
Wow.
But first, let's talk about some of the very obvious things that are going on in this movie, but worth bringing up anyway. Let's talk about faces. So one of the interesting things that happens is that his daughter, Jamie, is constantly changing the way that she looks and acts every week. So she says, "I'm supposed to be me." Not that you would have a clue about that anyway. And then later, when Castor as Sean says to her, "You haven't been the same since Michael died, hiding behind other faces to avoid how you feel." And then I guess what we're supposed to take away from this is that, ironically, only by putting on another face can Sean move past the death of his son, as evidenced by him not needing the bullet wound scar anymore at the end. You know, he tells the plastic surgeon at the beginning that, "I'd like for you to keep the scar there as a reminder of my dead son, and I guess how I let it burden my life, and I am so torn up by the regret." And then at the end, he says, "You know what? You can leave that off." And then he adopts the kid. And then there's that thing he does where he wipes his hand from the top of the face down. He does that before his son is shot. He does it to his wife after he catches Castor. I don't really have anything profound to say about this other than they knew the title of the movie and they wanted to nail it home.
I'm sorry. Jim Carrey's The Mask that tackles this thing a lot better and a little more interesting.
What?
Oh. Hey, that's a good movie.
That is a good movie.
That's a great movie. I'm not going to talk shit about The Mask, even though Austin doesn't like this movie.
We should cover The Mask on this.
I remember there's that psychologist in The Mask that's all like, "We all wear masks." And
yeah, it's Ben Stein.
Yeah, exactly. There's something going on here, too. Like, in ancient Greece, the idea of I think it was prosopon is the Greek word, which basically means mask, and it's what actors used to wear over their face. And it was this idea that there's something about the performance and being a new person. And there's a lot of literature that engages with this idea of wearing a mask as this thing that is like the signal identity marker of a person, of a body, right? And if you could somehow live in another mask, then that sort of disrupts who you are and what you are. And that's why I thought the bit where they're like shooting into the mirror was, for me, that was kind of like the coolest part, because I was like, oh, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Like, no. Just beyond the fact that, again, Mexican standoffs all over in this movie. But I just thought it was really kind of cool at like a thematic and conceptual level as well.
You know, I actually thought they were going to go a little bit deeper with it. There's a part in the jail when Sean as Castor starts beating the shit out of that guy who starts attacking him because apparently he had slept with his wife and daughter or sister, whatever. And he starts, I think, losing himself a little bit. Like, he's like, "Oh, I don't actually want to become Castor." But it never really develops beyond that moment. I really was hoping he would struggle more with, "Oh my God, I'm actually becoming my worst enemy because I have his face on." But you know, he doesn't really get seduced by Gina Gershon. You know, he's able to keep pretty well in control, you know?
Which I like, because it's more about the struggle between, you know, him being a family man, having to put on this act of being a psychopath, you know? So,
yeah, that one moment of pause in the jail when he's just like, he's like going for it, and then he's like, "Oh, shit." But yeah, that could have been a cool exploration. I can see that.
Yeah.
It just sort of stops there, kind of like introduces that one time, and then he doesn't – I mean, there are a lot of people dying. I mean, he is shooting down a lot of people. He's like mowing people down. He has that one pause with the SWAT guy. He's like, "Oh, hey, Billy," or whatever the guy's name is.
Yeah.
But
he never gets seduced by Castor's life, which –
no.
I mean, maybe that's just not the movie, you know? This is much more of a good versus evil movie, and they never really – explore the shades of gray, which is fine.
He has to do drugs with that guy.
But he doesn't fit in, I think. Just because he has to, right?
I thought someone spiked his drink.
No. He knew he was about to take a drug. He was like, the guy popped the pill in front of him and he's like,
I didn't know if he saw it or not.
No, he saw it. He knew he was doing.
I think the film does address some grayness though, doesn't it? Because like when Castor is Sean, he kind of does some good stuff for the family.
Ooh, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
You know? So there is kind of some, like, even this fucking global terrorist who's an asshole, like, he kind of helps the daughter and he sort of
rekindles. He does help her out.
He totally, right? Yeah. And he kind of, like, rekindles some passion with the wife, even though I guess technically he – is that rape? Fuck, that is some sort of weird sexual. I don't know what the fuck's going on there. I'm confused now. But
it's advanced seduction techniques.
Oh my god! Yeah, it's not torture. Sexual.
I mean, he gets a lobster and all of these candles. If that's not
there is a story. You know, he gets the lobster, but isn't she like a vegetarian? Because later on, he's saying like, tells a story like there was this one girl and she was a vegetarian. That's right.
You later find that out. She doesn't say it during the meal though.
No, she would be like, "What the fuck is this lobster for?"
Yeah.
Also, shout out to the actor who plays Castor Troy's brother. I think that
he was good.
Awesome.
Oh, Niccolo Alessandro, Niccolo or something like that. Yeah, I like him a lot.
And I was saying, what happened to Joan Allen too? Because we saw her in Pleasantville that year, probably 96 or 97.
And then she's in the Bourne Identity. She's in one of the Bourne films.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in a long time.
Yeah.
So I did a little bit of research about this movie because I was like, you know, it's not the deepest movie in the world. We're supposed to show people the meaning, goddammit. So anyway, I found this essay by a guy named Robert Hanke called John Woo's Cinema of Hyperkinetic Violence. So I'm going to be citing from him. And he brings up a good point about John Woo's films before this. And so he is calling, well, this is what he talks about, but I am dubbing what he talks about the Wooian bromance. So in films like A Better Tomorrow and Hard Boiled, these are John Woo's films in Hong Kong, there's kind of this masochistic bromance among equals, and there's like this nostalgia for this gone sense of honor. These are essentially like male melodramas. Hmm. So it's oftentimes a cop and a criminal, and regardless of the fact that they hate each other or that they're diametric opposites, there's like this sense of identification between the two of them. There's this sense of intimacy. And it's kind of like if you've ever seen Heat, you know, that last part of Heat where De Niro and Pacino are like holding hands because they both go through the same pain. That's kind of what we see in all the cop versus gangster movies of John Woo's Hong Kong cinema before this. And it's interesting that in this movie that doesn't happen. The only thing that you could really say is that is intimate between Troy and Archer is that they're both fathers. But I find it really interesting that the terrorist in this case, Castor, is like just unilaterally evil. And the movie even frames the whole discussion as like a all-time battle between good and evil with all that religious iconography or the fact that the Mexican standoff happens in a church and stuff like that. So I found that to be pretty interesting. Hmm.
But you don't think that maybe that they need each other though? That there's some sort of like connective. Like,
yeah, it's
dialogue.
Like Batman and Joker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, the law wouldn't be the law without transgression of the law, and vice versa. Transgression of the law wouldn't be a transgression if it didn't have a law to transgress, right? So you've got this terrorist who wouldn't really have an identity were he not kind of counterpoised against the foil of Sean Archer and vice versa.
Yeah, no, I think that there's definitely something to that, and I actually want to talk a little bit more about that, because it does seem to suggest that Sean not only... He's able to find some sort of epiphany in things that he has to change about his home life or just him as a man that he's only able to get by either being Castor or by Castor changing something in his home. But I guess the distinction I'm trying to draw here is like when you have two people with their guns pointed at each other's head, which is like the poster for a lot of John Woo movies in Hong Kong, it's usually like two guys who have the same struggle and they're all just products of their environment and just because of the way that society is, they've just been thrown into this situation where they have to fight and kill each other, but they still hold on to this common sense of honor.
This one is way more like nihilistic popcorn movie version of his.
Well, Castor Troy is definitely the nihilist, which is interesting because he's Jacob.
Like you said, he's a pure definition of evil. Like there's nothing, there's no motivation that you can kind of reason with.
Just money and women, drugs, you know.
Good time.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
In a way, though, that's interesting. So then he's like pure instinct, and Travolta is like manicured. I have to, or Sean Archer.
Right,
I should
he's
say,
pure good,
like,
you know. In a
yeah,
way.
Like I have to follow the law, angelic. And I am upholding this higher standard. And so it's almost like you get this commentary on human nature versus society. Like maybe Castor is what you are when you don't have the law and you need the law, but you can't have too much of the law because then you become a stiff and. You forget about like how to connect with people at another level, like his daughter and his wife and stuff like that.
I mean, obviously there's a connection going on because they have to inhabit each other's identities in their bodies.
And they know each other.
So I think this is almost
kind
of like a development of what John Woo was doing in Hong Kong. I'm having a hard time putting it into words, but there does seem to be something changing.
They both experience like this emotional connection when they're exchanged. Like they understand each other better once they're exchanged. So you have Castor in the home. He does eventually defend the daughter. He is a little more intimate. Like he has some moments of sensitivity. And obviously Sean's already he's pretty sensitive already, but then he's able to hang out with Gina Gershon and have like this emotional connection with this. Hey, these are friends. He actually cares about that dude.
Because before he was saying that, oh, I'm going to like put your kid in a foster home if you don't cooperate.
I'm gonna destroy
you.
And
then at the end, he realizes, oh no, like
I'll take care of you forever.
Exactly.
Yeah, or you'll never have to have a problem again.
Do you think that when Castor goes to the grave of the son that he killed, does he actually feel a little bit of remorse?
It was not painted to make you feel that way. Like it didn't seem like he. He seemed pretty cold. I mean, he was there for her, but it was clearly a gesture.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like he was like, I fucked it up.
Yeah.
But he did say, hey, look, it was an accident, man. He did say at one point, he tells him, he's like, hey, I was trying to kill you. Your kid was just an accident. I wasn't planning to. So there's a little bit of like a glimpse of remorse. But then he does say like, he does something like to really stab at him like, hope you enjoy that your kid's gone or doesn't he say something nasty to Sean?
During an interrogation, one of his like hoodlums or something says like, "How's your dead kid?"
Oh, that one.
Like
that's
that.
What it is. Yeah, that's what it is. Okay, that's what it is.
What do you think? You think, Ryan? You think that does Castor Troy undergo any changes when he is Sean?
Yeah, I feel like.
Or his brother. When his brother dies, I mean, you see a little bit of, but that's already. It's always been there, I guess. That warmth for him.
I think that he's clearly like having fun with. Being Sean Archer, and so to me, when he's helping the daughter out, when he's helping, it's actually not like, you're not supposed to say, oh wow, he's really giving her great advice. Like it's like fucked up advice to give a high schooler a butterfly knife and say just dig it into the wound so it won't open,
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of, you're also like, well, it is helping her protect him. herself.
But I mean, how cathartic is that moment when he beats the shit out of the
boyfriend? Oh yeah, it's awesome. So I feel like, he's just pure, whatever's in front of him, he's going to do what he wants to do. And I don't think that, to me, I think the funeral scene as the ultimate, like, middle finger to the Troys or to Castor Troy, because he's putting on the grief, but really, he doesn't give a fuck about any consequences or collateral damage to his selfish acts. I feel like at the end, and then at the very, very end, the ultimate fuck you is he's about to die. He literally says, "Hey, let's just kill each other. Fuck it." He's that nihilistic when he shoots at the mirror. Like, and then he's like, "Well, I'm gonna die, but just to fuck you over, I'm gonna take a knife and fuck your face up."
Yeah,
It
doesn't end up doing anything anyway.
Yeah, but still, it's just kind of like. He's only doing it out of spite because he's a dick. I don't feel like he's the personification of evil. He doesn't grow at all.
Yeah.
We also got Margaret Cho in the movie too. Did you guys catch that?
I did.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she was good.
I saw her name in the credits. I was like, whoa, I didn't even realize she
it's
was
such
active
a crazy cast. CCH Pounder is in it. It's like Thomas Jane is in it. Like,
what
the fuck?
He's awesome. The whole police squad's really good. I believe them.
Yeah,
across the board, it's a great movie.
Another thing I found interesting is that the stakes of the movie, at least for the bulk of the movie, are not some kind of existential threat, because the bomb is diffused in the middle of the second act.
Mm-hmm.
I found that to be pretty interesting. What's more at stake seems to be his family life, because it's like vaguely hinted at that Castor is, what is he? He's going to use the counterterrorism resources to put all of his competitors out of business. I don't feel like that's like a throwaway line toward but right before the showdown, what we really care about is how he's affecting the family.
Well, and it's just a pure revenge movie at that point. Like at that point, when he said I got him to his wife earlier, the assumption was that he was dead. He didn't realize he was in a coma. He's still alive. And not only that, he's also, so he defused the bomb, but now he's escaped and he's at large. And it's now just a revenge movie. Now it's just like, I want to see this guy done.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, he just wants to kill this guy.
Well, you're talking about
Sean. Sean wants to kill Castor.
Well, he also wants to get his family back. I mean, this guy.
Oh, yeah, of course. Those are the stakes, is that this guy's. Well, he's also manipulating the FBI and he's killing people there and he's taking advantage of the role.
We don't really see him. I mean, I guess he does take advantage of the role, but I guess.
Well, he's putting
it's
like
no longer that Troy is trying to harm a large population of people, which is usually the case in like terrorist versus counterterrorist
right.
scenarios.
Well, but now he's changing his strategy because now he realizes that he's got the inside beat, and so he arranges for his brother to kind of get all of these like good food and whatever else, these like nice material comforts, and rather than being in that maximum security prison. And he's gonna, like, for me, it was a lot more of the unsaid. Like, I just assumed once Caster has Sean Archer's face, he's able to go in, and that you can kind of see he's kind of like, okay, I'm in here now and I'm gonna start doing stuff that is totally for my benefit. And I mean, maybe he doesn't really just want to see the world burn, but maybe he's just down to make a shitload of money and have power. And he realizes that now he's got quote unquote state power, that he's able to kind of use those resources and do that.
He's a lazy Joker.
Yeah, he's able to put the SWAT team, like when he's playing Sean, when Caster's playing Sean, he's able to put like all these SWAT teams and all these police forces in at risk just for his own, like at his own whims. Like now he's got an army that he can just kind of put out, and they all get massacred.
He's got the power.
Over and over again. He's got the power.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying that even if the terrorist infiltrates the FBI, has all these resources to him, as a screenwriter, you'd probably say, okay, now we up the stakes even more. Now he's going to blow up the whole planet or something like that. Yeah. You know, that's usually where the quote face-off leads. But instead, you know, that Mexican standoff is basically just like a standoff between a bunch of mothers and like girlfriends and dudes. Like, it's much more family oriented, which I found to be interesting.
It's a family film.
It literally is a family film. Mm-hmm. It's a terrorism movie mostly about family.
Yeah, I love that genre.
Do we ever see why he's a terrorist though? Like, is it for money?
No.
Like, how come he has such a badass penthouse? So clearly there's some sort of monetary incentive. No?
There was that weird thing when Sean was in jail and he said something about like, man, fuck about that $11 million, right? What was that about? You know what we're talking about?
Oh, the brothers saying there was, I think, for building, they built the bomb and there was a deal where they'd get paid $10 million to build it or to engineer it or to install it. So okay. They're in cahoots with someone else. There's a money arrangement involved.
Okay.
And they said now that it's been diffused and that we're in jail, we're not gonna get paid for whatever.
Yeah, I think
that's what it was.
So there is a sense in which there's a pyramid of power and that he's not quite at the top, right? That somehow, somewhere globally in this non-specified terrorist
network.
He's
a freelance terrorist. I mean, yeah. You're saying there's someone who's like the boss.
Yeah, he's a contractor.
He's a contractor. He's a government contractor.
Yeah, and so somebody's footing the bill. And so, because that was my thing, like no one, except for the Joker, and very rare other characters, right? It's very rare that you find an enemy that just simply wants to watch the world burn. Usually it's they want to do it for money. They want to do it for power. They want to do it for the kingdom, or they want to do it for their people or something, right? There's always some sort of motivation. They don't really explain it much, but I kind of just assumed it was like money and power and chicks and sex and stuff like that because of his lifestyle being quite lavish.
Yeah. Well, it's also important to mention that he does care about his brother.
Yeah, as I say, that's the part, that's where you really see the heart of Caster, right? His brother dies, he's devastated. I think he does kind of cry, or he's teary-eyed.
He does, and he ties his shoe, which is like a really sweet little kind of cute thing. And he fed him his pill every day, the Vivex or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
You know, when I was doing research on this movie, it was so funny reading these old articles about how John Woo was this controversial filmmaker and how this movie was heavily criticized for glorifying violence and that films like this are often target such criticism. I find this funny because it feels like this is kind of no longer an issue. Like
people
people may react strongly to gore these days, but in terms of action violence, it seems like people are just like, all right, well, in as much as there are Hollywood movies now, there has to be violence similar to this, because this movie isn't even gory. There's maybe gunshots or something, but I don't really see how this is any more violent than your average Marvel movie, and nobody is complaining about those being too violent.
We've become desensitized.
It's pretty violent.
Yeah, I mean, the just sprays of gunfire, people just, you know, lots of people get murdered in this movie. I mean, then the slow-mo really accentuates the violence. And
it's like this.
Well, that's true.
It feels like the Matrix fight scenes, like the Matrix scenes when they're like flipping and doing the machine gun action, but it's like that for close to an hour and a half.
I mean,
the
Wachowskis
movie.
Were heavily influenced by John Woo.
Yeah.
And they loved John Woo.
I was saying to Jared earlier today that also the part where Castor wakes up and he's like, he has no face. He's like clapping. Right. And then he's like staring into his reflection, or you see his reflection in something. Mm-hmm. I was like, do you think Heath Ledger like got inspired for the Joker through that performance? Because he's like clapping his hands like the Joker. And then you just see like the smile.
I don't know.
I would love to think so. I would love to think there's some Nicolas Cage.
Cage in Dark Knight.
In the Dark Knight, yeah. Yeah, the whole thing with the slow motion, I guess I can see how that's a distinction, but it's like violence. The reason why there were, I guess, so many violent movies back then. I mean, I still contend that there still are today, but that's because the only thing violence lets movies travel well.
Violence is so common now. Game of Thrones, yeah. Spartacus, fuck, even like the TV show Fargo. It's everywhere now. Before it was like a thing that was in a small pocket of cinema. Right, you had certain directors or certain filmmakers that were known. I mean, Sam Peckinpah is the one that I think of that like really was like one of the early guys that really got shit for the radical violence that he displayed in his westerns, right? And then obviously Tarantino became the poster child for exaggerated violence, but now it is ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
Actually, it's really interesting that you brought Sam Peckinpah up because I think he's the perfect counter guy to John Woo, like or from the earlier generation. Like they both have very, very cinematically shot violent acts in their films, and they're in slow motion, you know. It's literally the same thing. So I think it's just the fact that he composes his violence to be extra, you know, crazy, that it just comes off like, all right, he's really into this. You can feel it.
Yeah, see, for me, the difference between Peckinpah and Wu is that Peckinpah, and I used the word earlier, balletic, there is a dance. There's an orchestration to it that Peckinpah doesn't have. Peckinpah is more of like naked brute, the brutality of violence. So when he does a slow motion or when he does a crash zoom, it's much more visceral. Whereas I felt like for me, it actually was... It was distilled a little bit because of the stylistic nature of the explosions and the fireworks. I mean, clearly when the airplane is crashing into that hangar, there are fireworks going off. That's not really what it looks like when a big fucking vehicle crashes into a door. So for me, it was much more spectacular in the literal sense, like a spectacle, than other forms of violence. So I actually didn't think the violence, for me, and maybe it's because I'm just a fucking desensitized motherfucker now, but it wasn't that kind of like horrific in this film.
I wouldn't call it horrific. It was more just, like you're saying, operatic. I also think that...
gratuitous. Boats flipping around in the air. I mean, it was like, wow. It's huge action sequences, but violent. I mean,
another element that lends to that, I think, is the score. You know, it's this heavy, like, cathedral-like operatic score that makes it feel like... intense, you know.
Was it Mancia? What's the guy who did the Speed soundtrack? Like, it sounded like that kind of intense... I don't know, but it's action music.
Like choirs and stuff.
Yeah, choir. It was good. Great stuff.
So more to Austin's point. So in an interview, John Woo said, speaking about his slow motion gunfight sequences, he says, "In those sequences, I was very influenced by musicals like Singing in the Rain and West Side Story and dancers like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. They have a rhythm of life, and I shoot action scenes just as if they were dance sequences."
100%. Like for me, and I know that I'm probably just being... fucking white boy trying to synthesize any Asian person. But I was thinking of like Jackie Chan and like Rumble in the Bronx and how it's kind of like, you know, this sort of Buster Keaton choreographed sort of thing. Like for me, that's what I was thinking of when I watched this. Whereas when I think of a Tarantino type or even a Peckinpah type, I don't think of them in terms of trying to create choreography as much. Even though I think Tarantino's like car scene in... is it Death Proof or the other one? Where,
Death Proof.
Yeah, like that is kind of, you know, extremely stylistic, but nevertheless, it doesn't quite have that like that balletic, like the choreography of this huge cast coming together and weaving these different dance moves together. Whereas you do get that, and I wonder if it's an like a characteristic of Asian cinema versus maybe a more American or European cinema.
Well, the thing about John Woo is that he is kind of like the big Chinese anomaly in that, yeah, he made a big splash in Chinese cinema, but that was because he was more influenced by Western directors than he was Chinese directors. So he cites people like Scorsese and Penn, Jean-Pierre Melville, Bergman, Bertolucci. And of course, Kurosawa. No, that's an Eastern director. But when he made his first films for Golden Harvest, which is the Hong Kong Chinese production company that made all those initial really popular movies of the 80s, he researched Jean-Pierre Melville's Les Samurai and Clouzot's The Wages of Fear, which I found to be pretty interesting. And it's funny how in his career now, you know, he had his time in Hollywood and then he went back to China. And now he's like really a national icon and he makes movies that are like, you know, lionize Chinese myths and stuff like that.
Hmm. That's kind of cool. You see, I'm not as familiar with his earlier Hong Kong cinema. It makes me really
want to
go back.
Oh, you got to watch it.
Yeah.
Have you not seen Hard Boiled?
God, I know I have seen a couple of them just, you know, on like on
it's
TV
amazing,
when I was
dude.
Younger with buddies, but I don't even remember what they were. I just remember like I had friends that were big cinephiles when I was younger and were watching them, and I don't remember what they were.
But yeah, Austin, if you watch his earlier stuff, I feel like you'll totally see like, oh, you know, this all comes into play in Face Off. Like the style is the exact same kind of.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He really translates. It makes Face Off make more sense if you see the earlier ones. I feel
there's certain films that you can watch in a vacuum, you know, like if you just sit down and watch The Spectacular Now, you don't need to know about James Ponsoldt's filmography and stuff like that. You can kind of just enjoy that movie, right?
What a weird reference.
I know, it just popped into my head. But you can just watch that film as a one-off, whereas I feel like you can with Face Off, you can just watch it. But I feel like you learn so much more. It's so much richer if you have a little bit of knowledge of the backstory. And I felt that when I was watching it. I felt, because I've seen Broken Arrow, and so I've seen, and I've seen Wind Talkers, but I've never seen, that I can consciously remember at least, that I can recall any of his Hong Kong films. So it makes me feel like it would really flesh out a lot of those gaps in my appreciation of this film had I been able to contextualize it better.
Yeah, and Broken Arrow also has John Travolta, and also, it's kind of not that good. Has some good effects in it, but Jared, correct me if I'm wrong. Does John Woo not speak that much English? Like is he one of those directors that has to have a translator? Which to me is always just blows my mind how you could do that.
I think he's from the mainland, and I think during the time when he grew up, they weren't teaching a lot of English. I don't know
if anyone knows out there, let us know in the chat. And
but you're working with just such pros, but at the same time, yeah, like every little performance would matter if you got the intonations wrong and stuff in terms of being an international director without the language.
I would actually love on this podcast if we did like some Hong Kong cinema movies. I mean, you look at Chow Yun-fat in like the early 80s doing a better, I think it was like 1984, he did A Better Tomorrow, which is, to me, it was weird seeing Nicolas Cage with two ornate guns and a flowing trench coat, because that whole aesthetic was developed in Hong Kong. It's weird seeing a white guy with that, because, you know, John Woo hammed it up all throughout the 80s, and then Wong Kar-wai made it like a art house aesthetic in the 90s with like Fallen Angels and stuff. And so then now to see Nick Cage doing it, I was like, okay, this is a little bit awkward, but hey,
you got
I kind of dig
later.
It all. I'll see Nick Cage do pretty much anything.
And the Matrix with the trench coat, man.
The trench coat. But that was like
it was a different version of it.
The cyberpunk version.
Yes.
This was like the same thing, which kind of made it a bit awkward.
The gold guns
for me.
and all that.
Yeah. Because we don't really have gangsters like that. You know, the triads are much more believable. Or maybe that's only because I know nothing about China. You know, maybe I just am willing to believe that Chinese gangsters are more like that. And our gangsters are not. Anyway, guys, do you have anything else you want to talk about before we go into the mailbag?
I didn't come into this podcast with much to say except for I love it. And it's been interesting. I think you showed me some meaning with John Woo. That's cool.
I mean, I guess if this is Nick Cage month, where do we think this film stacks up in his filmography? Is it a middle of the road or is it up towards the upper tier?
I mean, those first 20 minutes, I think, are pretty important for establishing the character, and I think he did a great job. I mean, we talk about his nihilism and stuff, and I love his lines like, well, you better pull the trigger, because I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And his whole thing with getting the flight attendant to suck his tongue. Yeah, I mean...
And apparently that's a thing, because Gina Gershon mentions that later, too, so...
Right, he does it regularly.
Yeah.
Have we all gone around and said our favorite Nick Cage movies? I mean, has that been?
Well,
did we say that for the end? Or
The end of the month.
The end of the month. I mean, maybe. I mean, I'll go ahead and spoil my mine right now. Is yeah, one of them might jump up, but mine is Vampire's Kiss. I mean,
that's like, your that number
movie,
one.
That movie really is very special to me. I feel like this last podcast, if I just got five people to watch Vampire's Kiss for the first time,
and we
I
all
feel
loved
like
it.
I'll have done something great.
That's like my brother with his vegan food company. It's like, I just want to make the whole world vegan. You want to make the whole world Vampire's Kiss lovers.
I want Vampire's Kiss to have a reawakening.
It'll happen.
What about you, Ryan?
I'm looking at his filmography right now. I mean, because this is certainly up there.
He's huge. I haven't seen.
I'm gonna tell you that my top. Damn, he's in so many good movies. My top three, I believe.
How do you even rank adaptation against something like Vampire's Kiss?
Right.
You just do. I think my top three are Adaptation, Wild at Heart, and Face Off.
Wild at Heart.
See, I forget that you are a big Wild at Heart lover.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I am excited to see it again.
For me, I just forgot. I was like, Mandy's up there. I love it, but that's very new.
And I gotta put Bad Lieutenant Portocol on there.
Thank you.
I mean,
I just made Alec watch it, and he did not like it, and Jacob doesn't like it. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with these people?
I know.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, real quick, I just want to say, to sum up Face Off, can we say, to kind of correct an old famous idiom, before you judge a man, walk a mile in his face.
Yes, I like that. But having said that, I don't feel like either, well, no, we already covered that. Never mind. You're right.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season one, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
All right. Into the mailbag. Let's start out with some voicemails. Ryan, what do you got for us? Oh, before you do that, I want to remind you, if you guys want to leave us any comments, ideas, jokes, analyses, whatever you want, 213-534-8807. Or what?
Elfgut.
211-ELFGUT07.
Elf Hut. It's also Elf Hut, which makes way more sense.
It sounds like Pizza Hut, which I like.
Why? I mean, elves have guts and elves can have huts.
Because it's just elf gut.
Every elf has a gut. I don't know if every elf has a hut.
That's true.
But it's like Pizza Hut. Elf Hut. I feel like elves living in a hut makes more sense than elf gut.
So it's 211-ELFGUT07? Yeah. Well, I'm working on that. But whatever, leave us a voicemail, or you can send us an email at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co.
All right, what do you got for us, Ryan?
Someone named Tony. Let's hear it. Tony?
Hi, Wisecrack. Tony from Northern California here. I'm calling about your Big Lebowski podcast. I was struck by how none of you could remember your first impression of the movie. I saw the Big Lebowski in the theater, and it had a profound impact on me. These characters were larger than life caricatures of people I knew, of people everyone knows. Even if the plot was a jumble the first time through and the dream sequences were gimmicky, there was so much truth to the movie that I had to come back for more. And when you do come back, the thing that really gets under your skin is the underlying message of perspective. We see one character after another with wildly different values thrown against each other. And the result is absurdity. Nobody has the right perspective. Nobody has the answers. And the dude's philosophy starts to make a lot of sense. In a way, learning to empathize with the dude is a lot like a reset button on all the hang-ups you've had driven into you by other people. Parents, peers, cultural leaders, the media. The movie makes an assertion that it's all noise. Nothing is absolute. Nothing is more than, like, your opinion, man. As the narrator sums it up at the end, the human condition is a comedic cycle, so we might as well just chill the fuck out and enjoy the ride. I think that the people who don't get the Big Lebowski might be so deep in their own beliefs that they can't see them for what they are. Beliefs. What do you think?
Amen, bro.
Man, this guy needs his like own YouTube channel. he's got a nice voice. Yeah. I think that was very well said. Yeah, I feel like my spirit movies for 2019 are The Big Lebowski and Philomena for similar reasons, for basically what he said.
I've never seen Philomena.
Philomena's wonderful. I haven't seen it in a long time. I don't remember what like the cathartic
There's like
twist
a part
was.
Where basically she so says good. Like, you know, yeah, you might be right, but I don't want to live my life angry, so fuck you.
Yeah, just like, fuck it off. Yeah, just like... Whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go bowling.
Yeah, so fuck it. Let's go bowling.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that was a great email. Totally agree on everything he said.
That was a voicemail.
It was a voicemail. You're right. All right, what do we got next? I think we got one.
Austin, do you have anything to add to that?
I concur.
All right. Kai. Bring it, Kai.
Hey guys, it's Kai calling for the Show Me the Meme podcast in reference to Bandersnatch. I know you're sick of hearing about it, really. I'm super sorry. But I wanted to reference something in relation to the episode for The Vampire's Kiss when a caller said that it was similar to Roy in a way. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think about the idea that if we do live in a simulation, the question of who is simulating everyone immediately jumped into my mind. I don't know if there's really a weight to that in relation to, in Bandersnatch, you know, you're controlling Stefan, but it doesn't answer if he's in a simulation, then who's controlling Colin, and who controls his dad, and who controls his mom, and even if we are avatars of greater players, why they would choose to simulate everyone, and who gets to be the NPCs, and who gets to be the characters. It's just something I couldn't get out of my mind after he said it. I'm sitting here at work, I've been thinking about it for a couple of hours now. I just wanted to let you guys know and see if you guys had anything to say about it. All right, have a good one.
Sorry to ruin your weekend, man.
Ryan, I know you believe we're living in a simulation. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I too had a moment where I thought about it for several hours when they go, "Oh my god," you know, like I mean, I don't have anything other to say than just strap in and enjoy the simulation, man.
The only thing I can say is luckily we don't
glitch
like,
out.
We don't glitch out.
You don't know
like,
if you don't glitch out. What if you glitch out? It just goes back.
I've never felt like
it.
Somebody trying to move my hand, and
exactly.
I've been resisting it.
It's
like
very
Stefan.
Good technology.
Well, that's what I'm saying. At least in our simulation, it's better technology.
Yeah, right. We're in a version. Yeah, that was from the 80s, man. This
really,
is
you've never desired a Coke, and then afterwards you've been like, "Whoa, why do I want a Coke right now?" And you realize that it was just like some hot person on a.
Oh, it's the hummus, dude.
No,
like your hummus blackouts.
You know. Like in the Matrix glitches.
This is from Heidi. Let's see.
Hit it, Heidi.
Hey, my name is Heidi. I just wanted to share a quick take on Vampire's Kiss, and I'll try to keep it short. So my take is that Peter was actually bitten by the bat and developed rabies, which could explain a lot of the symptoms. So I think his medical symptoms combined with his psychology to develop this elaborate fantasy that was basically a reflection of his deepest desires and fears. So I do think he's a very dangerous character, like in many of the ways that you talked about, but I also see a tragic element, and that if he did have rabies, or even if he was just having a psychotic break, he was quite sick and needed medical treatment, but no one was around to help him because he basically had shut out or abused anyone who might have cared in his life. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Okay.
Thank you, Heidi.
Vampire's Kiss
yeah, thank
is a
you,
goddamn
Heidi.
American tragedy.
See, that's what I'm talking about. You know, it's funny that someone had said last time that, like, you know, what's great about Vampire's Kiss, or what I think Nicolas Cage in the commentary said, you know, I like to keep movies up to interpretation. And I think that I love that too, but it doesn't always work. You know, like what I think my pick for worst movie ever made is the movie Southland Tales. And certainly that's up for interpretation. But you have to make the audience want to think about it. And I think Heidi's interpretation, which I hadn't even thought of, which on a literal level makes a whole lot of sense. And I really like it. It's just a reflection of how I think this movie is just so damn interesting and so fucking rewarding the more times you watch it, because it's hilarious. It's thoughtful on a level. And it's fucking hilarious.
I like movie, you know, because it is very ambiguous whether he was a vampire or not, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And it's on purpose, obviously. But I like, and sometimes I don't like that. Sometimes I'm like, I want
just
there to be
me.
A definitive fucking answer. But when it really does work, when it really at the end of the day doesn't matter, you know, it does matter. But either way, it's funny. Either way, it works. If he was a vampire, then that's a whole story in your head. If he wasn't a vampire, then you get that movie in your head, and it's still a great movie.
And we still have that sound effect. Oh, I guess we're not plugged in.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'm
sorry,
a vampire.
We're not plugged in. All right, I got one more.
I would also say another a movie that doesn't work in terms of being open for interpretation or just too ambiguous is Knowing. Nick Cage's Knowing. Have you guys seen this movie?
Wait, I don't think that movie's ambiguous at all.
You've seen that movie.
I've seen it. I saw it recently.
Okay, well, it's unambiguous, but at the same time, it has a million questions at the end. What happened at the end of that movie? All right, well,
spoilers.
That's for a different podcast.
Yeah, different podcast. All right, this next one comes from, I think, Ethan. Let's go, Ethan.
Hey there, Wisecrack. This is Ethan from Pennsylvania. I'm wondering what you guys thought of that in the context of the episode, you know, between the choosing between the binary choices and not really being able to abstain from the choice And that kind of application to our consumer society of, you know, choosing between two cereals but not really having an option to abstain from that other than just not having cereal. But yeah, let me know what you guys think.
That sounds like up your alley, Austin.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. I actually watched this again with a friend just the other night. And which was a totally different experience than the first two times I had played slash watched it. But one of the things that I picked up on in my first couple of viewings, but that really struck me with the last one, is the bit where you have an option to choose how you want to reveal yourself to him, either as the symbol or as Netflix. And if you choose Netflix, there's like this explanation that's trying to communicate with him. And one of the things that it says is it's like TV, but online. And I almost feel like there's a criticism. And I think we briefly touched on this. I don't know. I talked about this now with multiple people in different locations, so I don't remember what I said where, so forgive me. But it's almost like it's Charlie Brooker's making a criticism about Netflix as a platform in the way that where TV used to kind of like give you something, but now the choice is yours. It's all about you. It's you, you, you. And we already live in this sort of like narcissistic, personalized society where you can create an iced, non-fat, sugar-free, no foam, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you wouldn't have iced foam, but whatever. You know what I mean? Like this construction where everything is so personalized. It's so much about what you want to do to create your own personalized commodity, make you feel like you have control, but really you don't have control because the options are still given to you. And so it's this insidious way of sort of like programming us to kind of make us force ourselves to choose from within this array of options by giving the illusion of free choice. And I think that's something that's so interesting. And I feel like even Netflix as a platform is being criticized by this film or by this game film as well, because Netflix itself is part of that same sort of systemic tendency.
Are you sure you didn't get that point from an emailer? Because we got an email from Alexander who says essentially that.
I mean, I did an episode, like a bonus episode on Owls at Dawn. And then on my other movie podcast, we also did Bandersnatch. And I said it in one of them as well, because that's one of the things that I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm. So Alexander says, the days of simply browsing through Blockbuster and picking out what to watch on a whim are over. The movies and shows on Netflix on your homepage are displayed according to a highly specific algorithm designed to point you toward what Netflix wants you to watch, thus only giving you the illusion of choice. Netflix even came under criticism for allegedly using a viewer's race to determine what movie poster to display, seemingly going as far as to misrepresent a movie as more prominently featuring black actors than it actually did. Mm. So, by making Netflix a legitimate part of Bandersnatch, Brooker seems to be subtly pointing out that if our illusion of free will is present even within Netflix, then this illusion must permeate through the rest of our lives as well. What do you guys think? Is this a valid reading, or am I being too meta? Well, first off, Alexander, you don't get too meta on this podcast.
You gotta get some doom.
So, in economics, like public choice theory and social choice theory are two schools of thought that have dominated kind of neoclassical or marginalist interpretations of economics over the past 100 years, let's say. But like it got really, really, really popular in, let's say, the 80s, where people would run these focus groups. And focus groups would then sort of be the litmus test that would allow marketers to help governments and other corporations with their advertising or with the way that they would present a bill or a policy to the public through the media. And so basically, I think what this person is talking about is basically public choice on fucking steroids, where now algorithms are very precise, but also so fast and so ubiquitous with being able to kind of utilize the tools of big data or datafication, because everything is data information, that it's kind of like this, rather than asking me how I respond to the color of a new Cheetos bag or something like that, it's sort of just extracting it immediately. So it's basically that kind of focus group logic, but ramped up to 11.
And technology at scale, especially online technology, allows for that. Like the whole like optimization of the exploitation of your mind. You know, you can do that at such a large scale and so quickly and so precisely that on some fronts it becomes like, you know, it becomes optimistic and kind of nice, and you can, you know, make sure you have the best converting website for your mom's website that sells whatever cups or whatever.
It's awesome.
But down the line, it just gets to this hyper optimized place.
If you guys like thinking about this, I really recommend, there's a great YouTuber, Braincraft Vanessa Hill. She has a 6-part documentary called Attention Wars that's Probably the best thing on YouTube.
That's it. It's referred to as the attention economy in economic circles. So
yeah,
I would throw a wet blanket on this whole concept and just say that, you know, like I don't feel like I have an illusion of choice whenever I'm on Netflix, because you make the first choice that you make when you're on Netflix is, all right, I'm picking stuff that's on Netflix already, you know. So who cares?
I think Bird Box is a great example of this. Like when ultimately,
I think it's a great thing. Is all I mean to say.
No.
I'm
just saying. I think Bird Box. There's Netflix is making content, so already you're kind of selecting. I want Netflix's content, or I want NBC's content, or whatever. So I'm not criticizing, but I think like the reading
it's Alexander.
Alexander and Austin are kind of pointing to is interesting. Like Bird Box is an interesting case study. They got 42 or 46 million people to watch it because
Netflix says.
Right, which I think they'd be in some heat if that wasn't accurate, but who knows, right? But anyway, they're able to like take over every homepage and take over every login and take over billboards that they own. And they're just trying to see like what's our power to control choice if we want to use it at any moment. If we use everyone has that kind of reach, including Amazon. That homepage is super valuable real estate, or Google's homepage. But like if they want to use that, can they control the choice of what you watch? And it's promotion. I'm not saying that it's like full manipulation, but it's interesting to see that, hey, they could get and convince 46 million people or 42 million people to watch a movie that most people say sucks, you know. So
well, right, but you say it sucks. A lot of people like that movie, you know.
Yeah, I haven't met
a few people that liked it, but basically, yeah. If you're saying that they're scientifically finding out the few elements that they can all put into a box and make, you know, this amazing product. To me, that's on us if we all, you know, 42 million people are. You say manipulated. I would just say, you know, they made something that everyone likes. They made Coca-Cola. You know,
no one liked it. They felt manipulated to watch it. Yeah, they felt forced to watch it.
They did not.
You click out of curiosity. I mean, it's the same thing with YouTube. I mean, you don't. But it has nothing to do with whether you like the product or not.
Right. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Austin. But your take is that, you know, that this kind of hyper amount of choices, where they're using algorithms to figure out what the masses likes and then making those products, is kind of a bad thing. And I would say that it's just a machine, baby. You know, and it exists in the same world. It exists in the same world that really awesome independent shit is getting made too. You know, so we can have it all.
That's completely
true. Human beings are making their own choices. You know, I'm not being manipulated.
I thought you said you're in a simulation. I swear, I am saying these words. I am choosing to say these words.
That
sounds exactly like what the simulation would want you to say.
God,
exactly.
Damn it!
You've been compromised, Ryan.
All right. Yeah. Anyway. I was actually going to bring in one more email about Walkabout, but I feel like we're already too heated to get back to the lower level of Nicholas Rogue. All right. So I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. So
wrap it up.
What the last two remaining movies are for Nicholas Cage Month is in the hand of our patrons. So patrons, please
vote for adaptation.
Make it adaptation. Make it Bad Lieutenant 2. What else?
Or Walkabout.
Make it Raising Arizona.
Wild at Heart.
I would do.
Wild at Heart.
I would like to see Leaving Las Vegas again. That me movie too. Affected me in a very unique way.
That's so depressing, man.
It's definitely a downer.
It's great. Don't get me wrong, but
adaptation is fun.
Moonstruck would be cool.
Yeah, that's on there.
Peggy Sue Got Married.
That's not on there.
It should be further on the list. You're right. Knowing honestly would be really fun to talk about.
I think that would be fun. Yeah. I would be totally down if that was on there.
And you can re-listen to Mandy. You can re-watch the movie, but you can re-listen to the podcast on Mandy.
Con Air
or Nick Cage. Con Air, was Con Air on the list?
The Rock.
It is on the list. The Rock is not.
I vote for write-ins on Matchstick Men, please.
That is a good
movie.
I really regret
not remembering that one. Anyway, so where can we find you guys on the internet, Ryan?
I have my own website or my own page called Ryan Shorts. Release videos there every week. Made one today called Harmonizing with Myself. It's me and three versions of myself all singing together.
Nice.
Go check that one out. And Ryan's Game Show.
Yeah, Ryan's Game Show and Ryan's Shorts are are freaking awesome.
Oh,
the
man.
Best,
Wisecrack's awesome.
Oh,
I love y'all.
No, no, you're awesome. No.
And where can we find you, Jacob?
Well,
on Wisecrack.
On Wisecrack. How about you, Austin?
You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Hayden. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. And after a short hiatus, my other movie podcast that I do with a director friend of mine from London. Well, in London, I guess I should say. He's kind of multicultural. But it's called I Dig This Movie. So you can check that shit out. And the first film that we covered of the year is Point Motherfucking Break.
Ooh. Oh, hell
man.
Yeah.
Nice. Killer waves, man. All right, very signing nice. Off from... Actually, you do it.
Yeah.
Hold on, wait. I did save a few comments. That's
oh,
cool.
Oh, man.
From the comments
literally
section.
Wait until the last second. That's cool. Let's do it.
Sorry. I did fuck this. Fozzie Bear said, the 90s stereotype of a dad was a guy who was competent at work but incompetent at home. And that part was paint by numbers for the era. I thought that was kind of cool.
So he must... protect his competence at home, because that's the real threat, because who gives a shit if there's a bomb about to blow up the world? That's not as compelling of a conflict in the 90s. I like that.
All right. I can't find the rest. Anyway, all right.
All right.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California.
Peace, guys.
Bye-bye. Have a good night, everybody.